Welcome to the Harper's Podcast. My name is Violet Luca, and I'm the web editor. Some years ago, probably around 2007, I saw a photo of some graffiti written by US soldiers in Iraq. "We're at war while America's at the mall." Regardless of your politics, it's hard to disagree with that assessment. George W. Bush encouraged us to go out and shop in the days after the September 11th attacks, and a lot of people did, while his administration constructed the surveillance state, scaremongered about the axis of evil, launched military actions that led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, and consolidated power in terrifying, unconstitutional ways. Not that Obama or Trump did much better. They made it seem as though the war in Afghanistan was nearly done by drawing down troops, switching to drone warfare, dropping, quote, the mother of all bombs, and conducting the most aggressive attacks in the war's history while engaging in peace talks with the Taliban. In the September issue of the magazine, Andrew Quilty offers an account of the past 20 years through the lives of one Afghan family, a perspective that is so often ignored or distorted for political ends. I spoke with Quilty, who photographed and wrote the story, about a variety of factors that have reshaped the country and its uncertain future. As you explain early on in your piece, the impact of the United States' intervention in Afghanistan has been uneven at best, where cities, as most cities do, become more modern, while the more rural parts of the country remained more traditional. So where have you been since the Taliban retook power, and how would you describe the situation where you are now?
I haven't left Kabul since the Taliban took power, and that's for a couple of reasons. The most mundane of which is because of the fact that I'm a long-term resident of Kabul, and I have a lease on a house, and I have a dog, and I have I employ a couple of staff at the house where I live, and I have house guests who come and go, and I also have a community around me of, you know, friends and colleagues who at this moment have been going through an incredibly tumultuous, traumatic period, and who I've been, you know, like all my international expat foreign friends living here, trying to assist to get out of the country, as many of them have wanted to do, because they've, for good reason, felt threatened by the incoming Taliban. So that's partly why I've needed to stay close to home to take care of these kind of immediate concerns, which I suppose I wouldn't have to worry about if I was a journalist visiting from outside the country, and, you know, in which case I would be able to focus entirely on reporting and journalism. So it's quite a unusual set of circumstances, but the conflict actually hasn't been as difficult to navigate as I'd expected. It just, I mean, the urgency of getting people out of the country who felt as though they were in imminent danger, I mean, reporting all of a sudden didn't really seem anywhere near as important as those more urgent, critical concerns. And secondly, it's because, unlike almost any other time in which I've lived in Afghanistan, which has been for nearly 8 years now, I feel as though the heart of the story is in Kabul. Whereas in previous years, partly because of the lack of reporting that was being done out in rural areas, and also because it was where the war was really being fought, I always tried to spend as much time outside Kabul as I could. And yeah, so it's this strange dynamic where all of a sudden a couple of months ago anyway, the war kind of, or the front line of the war all of a sudden did a 180, and the guns which were previously pointing out from the provincial capitals were now trained on the provincial capitals and Kabul itself, and all of a sudden, you know, Kabul became the epicenter and the jewel in the crown for the Taliban. And so I've actually been quite a lot less anxious as a journalist being somewhat stuck in Kabul than I would have been at any other period of my time in Kabul, or in Afghanistan, I should say.
And the fact that you are deeply embedded, or you're not just visiting, let's say, like other journalists might be, you encountered the family you write about in your piece. They live in Wardak province, which is, it's a rural place, but it became of strategic interest over the course of the war, rather tragically. So what has happened with Abdul Jalil Anay's family since the time that your story went to print? So I'm thinking, like, you know, you finished it and it's sort of signed off, because there is for listeners, there's like a 2-month delay between when an author finishes a piece and when it's actually printed. So, and again, obviously a lot of things have been happening.
I regret to say that I haven't really been in contact with the family since the story went to print, mostly because of the rapidly changing environment here, politically and militarily. I mean, it was around the time that story got put to bed that the momentum of the Taliban on the battlefield was really picking up pace. And I remember just before we put the story to bed, we were updating the figures, we're updating the status of control of the 9 districts within the province of Wardak. It just, you know, right up until the day that the story got put to bed, and every day another district was falling in Wardak, and then, you know, on one day 2 districts would fall. So it was really building up to a crescendo 2 months ago, as you said, when this story was being signed off on. And so ever since then, things have been so chaotic on the ground, and you know, I suppose as a journalist and as a resident with certain responsibilities and friends and colleagues here, who all of a sudden started to see the writing on the wall and the necessity to make exit strategies. So yeah, a lot of the communication I'm sure I would have had with these like a lot of people, had it not been for the circumstances on the ground, sort of fell away in the last few months. And then certainly since the Taliban took control, I mean, there's been so many people I've fallen out of temporary touch with, just because, like everyone here, we've been consumed by what's been happening from day to day, and just trying to keep up not only with the news, but with, you know, more practical matters, like, you know, how to negotiate with our new Taliban guards at the entrance to our street, and you know, getting the press accreditation from the Taliban, and working out, you know, what's permissible and what's not, and, you know, can I ride home for a friend's place on my motorcycle late at night without getting in trouble? And can I have female friends over to the house, you know, bringing them past the Taliban guards? So it's been this, yeah, really huge transitional period, both obviously for the country, but also just on a, you know, more personal level for everyone.
Part of what's striking about the war is the extent to which short-term gains were prioritized above long-term ones by the U.S. military, and that goes some way to explaining why the U.S. was there for 20 years. Afghanistan's unemployment crisis in 2014, which led Nasrallah and hundreds of thousands of Afghans to flee to Iran for work, is a repercussion of one of those, quote, achievements, because that was the year when there was this huge troop drawdown and all the foreign investment kind of left the country. So from your reporting, do you understand this short-term approach as careerist of those in charge, or does it come from the fact that the U.S. military was never really suited to address what it deemed the country's concerns?
I don't think the generals and politicians in charge of running the war were necessarily deliberately careerist, but by virtue of the systems and structures by which the war was run, I suppose, you know, most soldiers who deployed here came in, you know, 6 or 9 or 12 or 18 month deployments, and then was cycled out. And a lot of that historical knowledge was cycled out with them. So I think it's more of a systemic issue than an individualistic one, where soldiers and officers came in looking to spend a short deployment in order to work their way up the ranks, although I'm sure there's an argument to say that that's the way it played out. I think it'd be cynical even for me to suggest that it was done deliberately by those individuals. That said, I mean, there isn't an American commanding general who hasn't gone on after their deployment as commander of US and or all international forces in Afghanistan, hasn't gone on to, you know, huge corporate careers or political ones, or with, you know, influential positions on with think tanks and the like, which is a strange kind of warped meritocracy where, yes, you have worked your way to the top of what at times during the 20-year war was the preeminent foreign military engagement for the US around the world. Sorry. After all these years, he still barks at gunfire.
Oh.
After 12 years. Moosh. Hey. Shh. He had a terrible ordeal the other night when the last American aircraft pulled out and there was about 2 hours of very intense celebratory gunfire. Mm. Almost barked himself hoarse. Oh. But yeah, this kind of this warped meritocracy where the commanding general of the world's greatest military force returns from the year or two deployed to Afghanistan, where despite all the public assurances, little has been achieved. Yet they, you know, walk straight in the front door of a huge think tank or into a chairmanship for Raytheon or Boeing or some other arms manufacturer. It's the success rate on the ground in Afghanistan doesn't seem to determine whether or not they'd be a good fit in the corporate world or in politics necessarily.
Right. So, you know, 2014, a lot of people had to leave. There just were no jobs, in part because of there was no more foreign investment, and also because a lot of the jobs that were to be had were obtained through patronage networks or sort of family relations. And we can get into that in a moment. But a lot of those people have returned. And now it seems we're in a time where people might be leaving again. So how has Afghanistan dealt with the return and exit of so much of its population?
Mm. Yeah, it's a good question. And I was asking a neighbor, in fact. I live next to a compound where the International Organization for Migration, the UN's migration agency, are based here. And, I mean, they evacuated, I think, on the day of the Taliban takeover. But before they did, Kabul, certainly, and Afghanistan more broadly, was at the beginning of another one of these mass exoduses like we saw in 2014 after the winding up of the international combat mission in Afghanistan. On this occasion, the exodus was happening for a slightly different reason. I think in 2014, 2015, which saw hundreds of thousands of Afghans heading for Europe, while a lot of people then were leaving in part because of the prospect of deteriorating security, the vast majority, I think the data suggests, were leaving because of the deteriorating economic circumstances. And you can kind of draw that out based on the type of people who were leaving, most of whom were young men, many of whom were presumably out of work since the huge war economy that had grown out of the American-led presence here had wound down substantially. And all those jobs in logistics and support and the general running of these... There he goes again.
The dog is a good reminder of how much gunfire there is right now. So I think it's yeah. He's made a fair point. So
okay, please good, continue. Good, good. I think whereas now the greater reason for the outflow of Afghans from Afghanistan is because of fear of the return of the Taliban in 2014, 2015. The root cause was, while also affected by deteriorating security and the resurgence of the Taliban, economic reasons were more of a driver back then than they are now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you once again you're seeing a really serious brain drain, and you know, which has happened. I mean, it began in the last couple of months as it became clear that an eventual Taliban takeover of the country was almost inevitable, even if it wasn't expected to come in, you know, as quickly as it did. And then, of course, once the Taliban took Kabul, even before the Americans had completed their withdrawal, that just expedited that the urgency to get out like no one could have imagined. And then the lure of these evacuation flights for many people who didn't even have valid travel documents, or, you know, I'm talking even people who didn't even have passports, which is quite unusual circumstances, I think, and shows just how critical the situation was and how, I suppose, determined the US and other international actors were to at least be seen to be doing the right thing by the people who had helped them here. But the brain drain that has occurred in the last 2 weeks since August 15 is just immense. I mean, you've had the backbone of the government and civil society and, I mean, not just the backbone of the Afghan press corps, but, you know, the works, you know, the backbone, the spine and the flesh, like it's all gone. There's very little left. I don't even know how that some of these networks are still functioning, but I think on a very, very much a skeleton staff, to go back to the human anatomy analogies. But it's really devastating this time, and just the speed with which it's happened is really hard to comprehend, and hard to comprehend how these aspects of society that have been built up, you know, quite successfully in the last 20 years will be able to recover, or if they will at all. I mean, there's very little even remnants left of some of these sectors. You know, I go back again to the media sector just because I'm familiar with it, and it's really hard to know how any of them will survive. Also, without the international funding that propped a lot of the or much of the media sector up here. Yeah, it's been a devastating few weeks.
And you have a podcast called Afghanistan After America, where you speak to Afghans who work in the media, who work in anti-corruption, a Taliban member, different people from different slices of life in Afghanistan. And you recently spoke with Dr. Yama Tarabi about corruption, kickbacks, and patronage networks in Afghanistan that emerged after the war. And the extent of the corruption has, to a certain extent, bolstered the public's opinion of the Taliban because, well, how can you trust, you know, to get anything done? You probably have to bribe someone. And I mean, Dr. Tarabi notes that it's not like corruption didn't exist in Afghanistan before the U.S. intervention, but there's a legitimate epidemic of corruption that extends through all parts of life. And that's, you know, things like construction, where there are ghost schools, or fuel to banking, to the security sector, you know, ghost soldiers, all these different things that, you know, people are getting paid for and not really following through on, and there's no repercussion. So what role has the international community played in creating this environment in the country?
I think the simple answer is that they've funded it. They've funded the corruption epidemic. For corruption to take hold, there needs to be money or resources or capital with which to undertake it. And it has just been funneled into Afghanistan with so little oversight. over the past 20 years that it's just become a bonanza for anyone wanting to make easy money skimming off the top or, you know, inventing new ways of graft. Like you mentioned, the ghost soldiers. I mean, I'm not going to say that this is the first time ghost soldiers have ever existed, but I guess it's at least the first time I'd heard of it, and you know, it was done very successfully. And
could you explain the mechanism?
Yeah, sure. It's so a ghost soldier is basically a member of one of the arms of the security forces who exists on paper but not in reality. So it may be someone who once had a role, had a position in the Afghan National Army, for example, but who quit or who was killed or injured and taken off the battlefield, but their name was never scrubbed from their personnel sheets. So their commander would keep receiving salaries on their behalf, keep receiving equipment and meals and all the other kinds of resources that are required for a soldier to maintain themselves and pocket it themselves. So not only does that undermine the mission of the army itself in securing, defending the nation and the government, but it undermines the morale of the soldiers who do exist and who are going out and risking their lives to do the job that they were tasked with. You know, so it's just one of the many examples of why I think the Afghan National Security Forces folded as easily as they did in the past couple of months, as soon as they came under some sustained pressure and as soon as momentum turned against them on the battlefield, there was this very little incentive for them to keep fighting and to risk their lives. I think that they would all have been asking for what, you know, for our commander who's been, you know, skimming money off our salaries for years, for this government who is not only corrupt but who doesn't necessarily represent our interests and is more concerned about his own welfare and those of the elites with whom he's surrounded himself and not about the interests of the people out in the provinces. So, you know, what incentive do we have to fight for our lives and fight for the life of the Afghan democracy? And I think the collapse of the government and the flight of the president and the collapse of all the democratic institutions and the security forces goes a long way to, I mean, there's your answer. That was the end result of all this sort of slow chipping away, white-handing, undermining of this system that the US tried to put in place and build and nurture over the course of 20 years.
And, you know, you see that impact, you know, like I said, it impacts all walks of life. But, you know, if somebody says that they're going to build a school and then they don't build a school, there's no repercussion. And that sort of leads us to the question of Afghan women. Because a not insignificant part of the justification for entering in 2001 was that, you know, rich white women would go on television, put on burqas, and would be like, I can't even see through this thing. And just as a yet another cudgel to sort of beat the country with after, you know, Bin Laden didn't turn out to be there. But the reality is that education for girls sometimes stops after sixth grade because there are no secondary schools. You know, sometimes they don't exist. Sometimes they're too far away. And I'm certainly not asking for a referendum on women's rights in Afghanistan. But do you envision the same city-country divide playing out with maintaining the, quote, feminism or the gender parity the army attempted to create? Because there are women in the country who are deeply invested in preserving feminism, but there are also a lot of women who are deeply invested in not participating in feminism. They want to, you know, maintain, you know, how they were raised. They want to raise their daughters the way they were raised. And, you know, that's quite frankly, they're right.
I think it's a question of having the choice as to whether or not to be able to put your daughters through school. And that is obviously what the concern is with the Taliban, that they eliminate the ability for families to choose whether or not to send their daughters to school. And I should also just qualify that by saying we don't actually know yet whether the Taliban will ban girls above grade six or above puberty from attending school. It's been assumed that that will be official Taliban policy, but a lot of the Taliban's rhetoric so far has been a lot more moderate than what was expected. And obviously, it is only rhetoric at this stage, and everyone here is holding their breath to see whether or not their actions follow the rhetoric. I think, as far as the urban-rural divide goes, aside from some advances in development of infrastructure like roads and better health clinics and schools in rural parts of Afghanistan, culturally, not that much has changed in the last 20 years, and not much has changed for that matter probably in the last 50 years. I think the choices that have been made available in the last 20 years have likely shifted the mindset in even more remote places, in areas like education in particular. But the concentration of the development dollars and aid spending has vastly favoured the urban areas in the last 20 years. So while those who were in the more populated provincial capitals and on their peripheries, I think you've probably seen quite a significant cultural shift in terms of, once again, education. But farther away, those very conservative mindsets are pretty well ingrained, and the poverty in these areas makes it difficult or extra difficult for it. It doesn't provide an environment that enables cultural change. I mean, for the people in rural parts of Afghanistan who live more or less subsistence lifestyles, where they often don't even own land, but they basically rent other people's land on which they grow a crop or a couple of crops per season or per year, from which they will take a portion to sustain their family through that year with food, the surplus of which they might sell at market. So they have a little bit of spending money for that year. But it's very rare for these impoverished rural communities to have enough money to be upwardly mobile, to send their daughters or their sons, for that matter, to provincial capitals to go to schools, let alone university. In fact, the poverty rates in Afghanistan have increased since 2007, 2008 significantly, which is quite a bizarre statistic to note, given the amount of money that has been invested here to eradicate things such as poverty, or at least to provide opportunities to eradicate or to lessen the burden of poverty across the country.
I mean, why do you think that is? Is it because of the corruption, or is it, again, sort of, there's not the, I want to say there's a better way to do it, but it just seems like there's not ever going to be a better way to do it. And we learned that lesson the hard way.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, that's another huge question, which I'm not qualified to answer. But I would say in the further the war went on and the more competitive the Taliban became on the battlefield, the more difficult it became to access areas that were under Taliban control or influence. And by 2015, that was, you know, a significant portion of the country. It was about 40% of the country. And that 40% of the country also happened to be the more rural, remote, and also impoverished parts of the country, underdeveloped parts of the country. So the aid and the development spending just never really got to a lot of these places. And instead, I suppose it was funneled to the places that required it less, although that's not to say that they didn't need it themselves.
Right. And just as with the corruption, over the past 20 years, Afghanistan has been used as a proving ground for new military strategies and technology. So there's a sort of a meta layer of not entirely ethical stuff going on. And I mean, obviously, drone warfare is the best known example of this, largely because they were imprecise, cruel, and often extrajudicial killings. You've written quite a bit about CIA 01, which is a CIA-guided Afghan strike force. Could you talk about that development, which it may not be new, but it's, you know, it plays a crucial role in the lives of everyday Afghans. And what other quote-unquote new approaches to war have been tested out in Afghanistan that are perhaps not as familiar to the public?
Again, it's not really my area of expertise, defense and ballistics and weaponry, but one in particular stands out, which was the so-called mother of all bombs, which was supposedly dropped on a ISIS cave complex in 2017, soon after Trump came to power. And it was a bit of a muscle flex, I think, at the time. It was the largest non-nuclear weapon ever utilized in wartime. Basically, this enormous bomb that gets pushed out the back of a C-130 military transport aircraft and, you know, has a catastrophic effect on whatever it's dropped on. And look, there's been very little reporting actually done on either the immediate outcome or very little serious investigative reporting other than what was dished out by the Pentagon at the time. And very little reporting of consequence on any after effects. There has been some local Afghan reporting done on some claims of birth defects or high incidence of cancer among people living in the area where it was dropped. But I don't think anything particularly convincing has been done yet. And perhaps it's even too early to know, but it also just goes to show the fact that Afghanistan has been used as a bit of a petri dish for testing new weapons and new strategies and tactics, I should say. Another one that you mentioned were these what were collectively known as counterterrorism pursuit teams, which were set up very early on in the war by the CIA. They're effectively tasked with chasing Al-Qaeda remnants and Taliban commanders around the border area and often across the border into Pakistan from east of the Durand line, the border that separates Afghanistan and Pakistan. And they, in fact, were some of the last Afghan security units to survive the Taliban overthrow, because they had such close relations and such protection in high places not with the Pentagon, but with the CIA. And as a bizarre anecdote to the end of this war, you actually had a number of these counterterrorism pursuit teams tasked with securing one or two of the gates through which Afghan, American, and other international citizens had to pass to get into the airport and get on these evacuation planes, which was bizarre. There are these extremely secretive paramilitary units, which, you know, are very rarely seen in public by anyone other than those who they are targeting. And even more bizarre was the fact that they were out on the perimeter of the Hamid Karzai International Airport, the international airport for Kabul, in what was essentially Taliban-controlled Kabul. outside the airport, and they were there, you know, to some degree with the blessings of the Taliban, who had developed this immense animosity towards over the years because of all the, not only the destruction they'd had on their membership, on the Taliban's membership and their leadership, but on the communities within which they lived in more rural parts of Afghanistan. 01 was the preeminent unit among about half a dozen of these counterterrorism pursuit teams. And I did quite a lot of reporting on them, and they are actually they were the perpetrators of the attack on the house, which is what the story in Harper's this month centers on. But that attack on that particular house was just one of a number of similar attacks, dozens in fact, that occurred over a period of about 18 months, which coincided with the time the Trump administration was engaged in peace talks with the Taliban in Doha. So it was this sort of double talk where you had all the rhetoric of peace and reconciliation on the one hand, and then on the other, you had this very shadowy war happening behind the scenes in parts of the country which were off limits to the media, and from which any information came out was always going to be assumed to be Taliban propaganda. So, and these were some of the earliest units that were built up by the CIA, by any American agency or organization, soon after the October 2001 invasion.
Afghanistan has a very low COVID-19 vaccination rate, in no small part because the CIA used a vaccination campaign as a mode of tracking and monitoring civilians. Has the Taliban been able to leverage COVID, and how has it impacted civilians?
You mean since they took control of the government?
In the sort of the lead up to the takeover and mm-hmm. now, I would ask.
I haven't heard mention of COVID-19 since long before it became clear that the Taliban were going to take power. It's become, very much a secondary issue here. And in fact, one of my housemates today, an American journalist, visited the COVID-19 hospital in the designated COVID-19 hospital in Kabul yesterday, I think. And he said that the admissions had gone way down since the Taliban took over, and that was partly due to the fact that there had been less spread and less infection since the Taliban had taken over, because people were staying home and were effectively isolating themselves in their homes, even if they were spending a lot of time with family in close quarters. They weren't mixing out in public as much as they had. But it was also because people are just nervous, and so staying close to home for that reason, because they, you know, feel as safe at home as they do anywhere. The Taliban, when COVID first broke out and the pandemic first spread to Afghanistan, they did make some early efforts to at least appear to be concerned about it. There was one amusing story where the Taliban organized a kind of press junket, which was quite unusual, even for just 18 months ago, where they invited a bunch of journalists from the eastern city of Jalalabad to an area in the neighboring province of Laghman. And they wanted to show off how seriously they were taking COVID, and everyone was wearing masks, and they had someone with one of those temperature guns. And it turned out that temperature gun was actually a couple of pieces of wood taped together with white electrical tape. So, look, I think any Taliban efforts to combat COVID were probably in their own self-interest in terms of getting, medical assistance and other kinds of funding and assistance from international NGOs. And I suppose for public perception purposes, to look as though they were concerned with, you know, this public health crisis.
Mm. And I wanted to go back to the question of the media networks in Afghanistan, because Tolo News was the first 24-hour news network mm-hmm. in Afghanistan, and Tolo TV, which got in trouble for airing an Indian soap opera that was very popular in Pakistan. It mm-hmm. also, you know, it's like this sort of media conglomerate, right? Tolo also owns Afghan's first privately owned radio station, Arman FM, which plays music. So could you describe the impact those media channels had on the country and sort of, you know, you say that they were running kind of on a skeleton crew, but the Taliban is kind of being like, hey, we're a softer, gentler Taliban now. You can listen to music, but maybe a scholar will, Islamic scholar will tell you it's bad. Could you describe sort of what the media environment was like before basically August 15th?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a little bit of a mirage in the fact that on the face of it, there were scores of television networks and hundreds of radio stations and numerous print news outlets, but a lot of them, I would say the vast majority of them, relied on funding from the likes of USAID. And I think the industry as a whole was always going to struggle to survive past the full US withdrawal and the divestment in media funding. But that said, I think it was one of the, in spite of the mirage-like nature of the sector, it was still incredibly influential and something that I think will feature in the memories of this generation of Afghans. I mean, I think it will really, the news jingles and the personalities, the presenters will really remain as icons of this period, because there was not only such a huge amount of growth in the media sector, but also in terms of communications and connectivity. It's, you know, very common for Afghans, certainly in the provincial capitals and the national capital, Kabul, to have smartphones and be, you know, constantly connected to the latest news updates, political news and international current affairs and so on. And even in rural areas, the preponderance of radio programs, it was of huge benefit, I think, even to rural communities, because of, you know, how little infrastructure is required to transmit radio broadcasts. So I think it's definitely been one of the greater success stories. But I suppose we also have to consider the fact that, you know, the greater the success of a sector like the media, you know, the more there is to lose now at this point where it's all under such huge threat. The founder of Tolo News and Tolo TV, Saad Mosseini, I saw quoted recently, I think, in the New York Times as saying that he was surprised to see that Tolo News, Tolo TV were even still up and running a couple of weeks into the Taliban. I think there was a wide assumption that the network would just fold immediately the moment the Taliban came into power and that all the staff would flee, because it was assumed that they would be, you know, that that'll have targets on their heads. And so, you know, it's another one of these, like the collective breath-holding exercise of the entire country, and everyone who's watching the country is also, you know, is particularly pertinent to the media industry, as it is for education, women's rights and the like. And
absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable that there'll be some level of restriction imposed on the media. I've already seen that in my day-to-day reporting. There are things which I think instinctively members of the Taliban don't want you to see, or don't want to enable you to document for others to see. And on the other hand, I think there is some thinking within the group that no, we need to loosen the shackles a bit. And you can see this kind of conflict, you know, in the minds of the Taliban, who are instinctively want to restrict me from, you know, taking a photo, for example, today of the queues outside banks, because, you know, this is embarrassing for the Taliban. It's showing the strain on the economy. And then at the same time, you see a little switch flick when he remembers, oh, hang on, no, we've been told, my commander has told me, you know, go easy on the media, let them do their work. So you have this cognitive dissonance between instinct and order, or orders, I should say.
Right. Well, thank you so much. This is really fascinating. And again, it's because you are in a unique position to observe this and have been observing this conflict. And I think it's rare information, and it should not be, quite frankly.
Thanks, Violet. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Harper's Magazine podcast, produced by Violet Luca and Andrew Blevins. The music is Cut and Shoot by Febrifuge. Harper's Magazine is the oldest general interest monthly in America, exploring the issues that drive our national conversation through long-form narrative journalism and essays. To get 12 issues for $21.97, visit harpers.org/save.